I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The United Nations has called drinking water a human right. Some have called the campaign to make water and sewer fees affordable for poor people a new civil rights movement. The rates that people in Baltimore pay for water have gone up exponentially over the last decade, and they will continue to rise for at least the next 3 years as the city struggles to pay for the $2 billion in repairs and upgrades our aging water system requires. Today, the impact of these rate hikes on the poorest among us. A new report from the Able Foundation cites what some cities are doing to make water more affordable for low-income residents. Joan Jacobson wrote the report. She joins me, along with Susan Francis of Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Services and Roger Colton, an expert in water billing systems. The problem's in the pipes. Midday starts right after the news. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us today. If you live in Baltimore, you have probably noticed two things about your water bill. First, it comes more often than it used to. And second, it's a lot higher. The cost of Charm City water has risen 127% over the last 10 years, and over the next 3 years, it will increase another 33%. The reason? Our water infrastructure is old, unreliable, and in dire need of an upgrade. There are roughly 4,500 miles of water pipes under Baltimore streets, and they break in various places about 1,000 times a year. Last year, sewers backed up into people's homes more than 7,500 times. By the end of 2015, the city had repaired 164 miles of sewage pipes, but there are more than 250 miles of faulty pipes still in need of repair. That's the distance between Baltimore and Syracuse, New York. That's a lot of miles of a lot of pipes. So to raise the $2 billion it will take to make the necessary repairs and upgrades, we Baltimoreans will pay more for our water. But there are a lot of people in our city for whom the increase in the cost of water is a hurdle that they have a very difficult time surmounting. Today, we're going to talk about the fiscal, moral, and practical dimensions of water affordability. Joan Jacobson joins me in Studio A. She's a former reporter for the Baltimore Evening Sun who has written a report for the Able Foundation called Keeping the Water On, Strategies for Addressing High Increases in Water and Sewer Rates for Baltimore's Most Vulnerable Customers. Hey, Joan, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Susan Francis is here in the studio with us as well. She is the Deputy Director of Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Services. She and her colleagues help people who are facing tax sale foreclosures that are sometimes caused by delinquent payments of water bills. Susan, nice to have you here as well.
Happy to be here.
And on the phone from Boston is Roger Colton. He's a lawyer, an economist, and a consultant who specializes in utilities and energy policy. He's looked at ways to make water more affordable as a way to help low-income residents and municipalities who provide the water. Roger Colton, welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
So thanks to all of you for being here. Joni, let me start with you. Outline the problem here in terms of what Baltimore needs to do to fix these ancient pipes of ours.
Well, the problem is that the city public works department, which unfortunately is not here today, they declined your invitation, which is too bad. They are faced with this massive cost, as you just said. And the rates have gone up to pay for it, but a very large amount of people cannot afford it. And their uncollected debt is more than $20 million from 15% of the residential water customers. That's 25,000 households who can't keep up with their water bills.
Okay, so they're delinquent in their payments.
Right.
And it's 25,000 people. I mean, about a quarter of the city lives under the poverty level
right.
as established
right.
by the federal government. Some of those same people are really having a difficult time paying the water bill. But the work that the city needs to do, let's start there. I mean, there's this consent decree
yes.
from
EPA
that was agreed to with the Environmental Protection Agency years ago. I mean,
yes.
2003 or something, and then
yes.
it was extended another five
right,
years
right.
because there's all this sewage that's flowing into the
Chesapeake Bay
and stuff.
Yeah.
So the consent decree says that Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, has to address this problem, fix it. But there's no federal funding
to do that, right?
That's correct.
Federal government no longer pays for it.
Not just for Baltimore. But
for every city, this is a problem in Detroit, in Philadelphia, in New York, in Washington. It's a problem in old urban cities.
And the fact that there are as many as 1,000 disruptions a year, is indicative of the fact that this system is really old and we don't have the capacity.
Right, that's right, and don't have the money to pay for it.
Yeah, right. But this affordability issue is another thing that the city, is trying to address in certain ways, but this report that you've written says they're dropping the ball and falling well short of what they need to be doing.
Right. They have several Band-Aids to help low-income people. They're certainly not enough. They have, over the last year, fixed some of their customer service problems. They hired a new head of customer service almost a year ago who's, I think, working extremely hard to fix some problems. Small example, there is a little-known medical waiver. If your water's about to be shut off because you haven't paid your bill and someone is very sick in your house, your doctor can fill out a form and stop the shutoff. There were only 200 households who had that waiver because no one knew about it. It's finally on the Public Works Department's website. That's one example that she's trying to fix. But the systemic problem is not being addressed by the city, and they really need to do that. And there is, if I can say, there's a really wonderful coalition that started a whole movement in the city. It's called the Water for All Coalition. It's made up of groups that include AARP, Legal Aid, Susan's group, the Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Service, Pro Bono Maryland, University of Maryland Legal Clinic, Public Justice Center, Food and Water Watch has an organizer who is organizing this group. And one of the things they are doing is working with the city council and state delegate Mary Washington to get legislation introduced in the coming year to fix some of this. And it includes Roger Colton's solutions.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Colton, we will get to those in just a second. But Susan Francis, with the Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Services, you are one of many, as Jones just alluded to, one of many organizations that's really taking a keen interest in this thing. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, subsidize housing. It's another thing to subsidize health care the way we do with Medicaid or something like that. But water really is, it's an essential element of human life. I mean, if there are people who, for whatever reason, cannot afford to pay for the water that's coming into their home, something has to be done as a matter of social consciousness, to say nothing of obviously the city can't simply give water away for free, but this is a social justice issue, is it not?
I agree. And first I would say, you know, those of us that are looking at this issue are very sympathetic to what the city and the Department of Public Works faces with their infrastructure crisis. But we don't think the appropriate place to put that burden is on particularly low-income individuals. And what we see is not just a matter of having the water shut off, which, you know, Joan illustrates some truly heartbreaking stories of individuals who are living with their water being shut off. But we have a secondary issue with Baltimore City, where then those homes actually go to tax sale. And so the stakes around affordability are truly as critical as they can possibly get. If you fall behind on your water bill, you either get your water shut off and or you lose your home entirely.
Right, so a shut off water could lead to sort of immediate homelessness. Explain how that works. So it's a municipal lien, is it not? For water, a delinquent water bill is considered a municipal lien. So there are people who can lose their homes. I mean, people can go in and say, all right, you owe too much money, we're going to sell your house.
That's absolutely right. It's a little bit of an anomaly. Normally, in most cities, a water bill would not put someone in tax sale. Tax sale is generally a property tax issue. But because Baltimore City owns the water department, they're able to kind of throw in this whole other element of delinquent payments. So most jurisdictions don't have water bill as part of a tax sale structure. And we think it's actually a better model to treat our Baltimore City Water Department in a similar way to all other public utilities and private utilities. If you're gas and electric, if you're delinquent on them, you get a shutoff. You don't lose your home. And they're regulated and oversighted in a more accountable way than what we have currently in the city.
And Roger Colton, you've developed something called the Home Energy Affordability Gap. What's that?
The Home Energy Affordability Gap is a study that I do on an annual basis. I look at actual home energy bills on a county-by-county basis for the entire country and compare them to affordable home energy bills, and the gap is the difference. The affordability gap is the dollar amount by which actual home energy bills exceed affordable home energy bills.
And how does Baltimore compare to cities around the country in terms of the number of people with a large gap?
Well, the city of Baltimore is, I would say, is a typical large, low-income, urban community. So it ranks up there with Philadelphia, with New Orleans, with Detroit, with having not only a large gap, but having a large number of people that are unable to pay their home energy bills. What we look at is the population of customers who have incomes at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. So we take the official line demarcating what represents being poor, which is called the poverty level. We double that and look at the affordability of bills. And in Baltimore, on average, home energy is unaffordable to people with incomes below 200% of the poverty level.
And Baltimore's rates compare about in the middle of the pack, according to Jones' report.
The water rates.
The water rates. Right. So, Mr. Colton, what causes certain water rates to be higher in some places and lower in others? Pittsburgh, the District of Columbia, and Boston are more expensive than Baltimore, but water seems to be cheaper in New York, Louisville, and Milwaukee. Why is that one way or the other?
Well, I can talk about some cities. Well, we're talking about water, but really, when we talk about water, we're talking about water and sewer. You can't distinguish between the two. Whatever water comes into your house has to leave your house, and that's why sewer bills. In Boston, for example, where I live, rates are extraordinarily high because the city was dumping sewage into the Boston Harbor. And as with Baltimore, the federal government told the city that they had to clean up the harbor. There was no longer federal dollars to help do that. And so it's all being done at ratepayer expense. As a general rule, however, it is the older urban areas that are facing high water and sewer rates. And it's for the reasons that you mentioned earlier. The systems are simply old. They have to be replaced. Number two is that the federal government no longer helps local governments pay to replace that infrastructure. And number three, something you didn't mention, is that many urban areas, including Baltimore, including Detroit, are becoming smaller. So there is a population outflow.
Yeah, we've had a population decline over the last, 40 years.
Sure. Yeah. So we're spreading more dollars over fewer people.
Right. And Joan Jacobson, give me an example. What's the trigger for the city to decide to shut off somebody's water?
Oh, I'm trying to remember. It's
My recollection of the report is that when you're about
$250 behind. Yes, and that's the trigger. And then they have to send notice. And I also might add that the water bills are only in the name of the property owners. So if you're a tenant, you've got a big problem because maybe your landlord has you pay the water bill to them, but the landlord has to pay the water bill to the city. And if the landlord doesn't pay the water bill to the city, then they can shut off the apartment building.
Renters are a distinct disadvantage.
Renters at a disadvantage. Although I will quickly say that the new customer service director this summer for the first time stopped shutting off water at larger apartment buildings. And decided to sue the landlords for non-payment, which is a step forward.
And they kept the water on while the lawsuit.
Yes, so that is a good thing that she did. But obviously, if it's just a single family home or a smaller building, you can get it just shut off to no fault of your own if you're a tenant.
Joan Jacobson's latest report for the Able Foundation is called Keeping the Water On: Strategies for Addressing High Increases in Water and Sewer Rates for Baltimore's Most Vulnerable Customers. Susan Francis is the Deputy Director of Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Services. She helps people who are dealing with tax sale foreclosure issues. And on the phone from his office in Belmont, Massachusetts, is Roger Colton, a principal with the consulting firm Fisher, Sheehan & Colton. He specializes in public finance and general economics. We invited Rudy Chow, the director of the Baltimore Department of Public Works, to join our discussion today. He declined that offer, and after repeated requests, a department spokesperson said that no one else at DPW could join us either. The department did send a written statement that says, in part, quote, DPW is expanding opportunities for people to catch up on overdue bills and extending protections for low-income seniors to automatically include hardship exemptions from bay restoration and stormwater fees. It also says that there are, quote, statements in the report, and he's talking about Joan Jacobson's report for the Able Foundation, there are statements in the report that fall short of accuracy. The letter goes on to claim that thousands of customers who use as much as 1,500 gallons of water every month will see their bills go down. We'll have reactions to the DPW statement from our panel after we take a quick break. We're posting the entire statement from the Department of Public Works on our website, wypr.org/midday. So even though nobody from DPW wants to join us, if you'd like to join us, you are welcome. Our phone number here is 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. You want to drop us a tweet? Our handle is @MiddayTomHall. More on water affordability when we come back after this 90-second break. Stick around.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, tomorrow we're going to take a look at another report commissioned by the Able Foundation. This one takes a look at the terrible problem of youth homelessness. Back in 2008, then-Mayor Sheila Dixon vowed to end homelessness in Baltimore in 10 years. Well, we've got a long way to go. The Able study has found that there are more young people facing housing insecurity than had ever been previously thought. More than 1,400 young people face chronic housing insecurity. We'll talk to an amazing young man. His name is Danny Jones. He experienced homelessness for most of his childhood, and we'll hear from the author of a study of the Able study and a woman who runs the only drop-in center in town geared towards young people. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. Today, we're examining the high water rates in Baltimore City and the reasons that those rates will continue to increase over the next few years, and how low-income residents, senior citizens on fixed incomes, the disabled, and others in need can avoid having their water turned off because they are delinquent in their payments. Roger Colton is an expert in utility billing. He joins us on the phone from the office of his consulting firm in Belmont, Massachusetts. Here in Studio A, I'm joined by Joan Jacobson, who authored a report on water affordability for the Able Foundation, and Susan Francis, the Deputy Director of Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Services. You are welcome to join us with your thoughts about the water system in Baltimore, about the billing system that's recently been put in place. We've gone monthly instead of quarterly, and your thoughts about making water affordable for those of our neighbors and citizens here in town who cannot afford it. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall, and our email address midday@wypr.org. DPW.org. So, Joan Jacobson, let's talk a little bit about the statement that we did receive from DPW, the Department of Public Works. And again, we did invite them to come. They decided not to do that. They say in part that they share the sentiment behind your report's recommendations that more needs to be done to preserve affordability and protect vulnerable customers. But you're saying they come up very short when it comes
yes,
to that.
Yes, I do think they come up very short, and I am disappointed that no one is here today. I have no idea where Mr. Chow, the director, stands on this issue. He declined my request for an interview for the study. He's not here today. He did not attend a city council hearing a few months ago about the water affordability crisis, although people from his agency, of course, testified. And he didn't even appear at a meeting between the Able Foundation and several public works officials to discuss the draft of my study earlier this year. So I think that's unfortunate.
Well, you mentioned, for example, that we have about 25,000 households in the city who are behind on their water and sewer bills, and there are payment plans. There are plans
so
that the city makes available for people who are in debt. But between 2015 and 2016, there are like 6,300 people who are on payment plans. I mean, it's a lot of people.
There were, but in that same time period, 5,000 of those payment plans went delinquent. So people couldn't even make the payment plans. Now, one of the big problems with the payment plans is that you had to come up with 50% of your debt as down payment until very recently. Very difficult to get. If you were low income, you could use the city's low income credit, which is now just under $200. You could use that credit toward your down payment. Now, there's a new down payment plan, which has no there's no down payment, but you can't use the credit if you choose no down payment. So you're still stuck. It's still very difficult. And I think the delinquency of the payment plans is very indicative to the systemic problem that people can't afford the rates.
Susan Francis, if you're representing somebody in the situation that Joni is describing here, let's say she's, you know, $1,000 behind on her water bill. She didn't pay the bill for a couple months, through 2, 3, 4 months. She's got penalties and all that kind of stuff. How do you advise her? How do you can you negotiate with the city to see that her water doesn't get turned off?
So that's a great question. If I can just quickly mention, in terms of the DPW statement, we have been a bit frustrated by, again, as Joan has mentioned, their lack of addressing affordability, and particularly with going to monthly billing, as you've mentioned. What we have found that with that's sort of been the solution, and that there's an implication there that the problem is just that people can't budget.
In other words, if we get a bill once a month, the number is smaller than it was when we were getting them quarterly, and so it's going to be easier to work that into our family budget.
And this is the way I liken it. If I have a car payment, if I'm making that monthly versus quarterly, sure, that's easier to budget. But if that car payment goes up 126% and then goes up another 33%, that's not a budgeting issue. That's an affordability issue. Secondly, there's been a lot of messaging around the affordability of they've eliminated minimum billing. So it used to be, regardless of how much or how little water you used, you would pay a flat rate. And so there's been a lot of messaging out of the Department of Public Works that the elimination of that will save homeowners and tenants money. So what we're seeing that's not quite true, frankly. And so we're sort of 2 or 3 months into the billing, and what has happened is there's been elimination of minimum billing, there's been a price increase, and there's now fees layered on top of that has half of your bill is based on fees, not based on usage.
Right.
So
can I jump in and just add, what minimum billing was the opposite of conservation. No matter how little water you used, you were still charged as if you used almost 7,500 gallons of water a year.
And DPW might say that one of the reasons to do it that way was to find out whether or not homes, in fact, were being occupied. They might be vacant. That was a way of
they were still charging vacant house owners the same minimum fee. But they have stopped doing that, which is really good. However, now thrifty water users will pay only for the water they use, so they might have lower bills. However, the extra fees that Susan just mentioned are new set fees that next year will total $226 annually on top of your water rates.
I'm looking at my water bill, which I happen to have just received yesterday. There's an account management fee
Those are the two new set fees.
That will set me back $250 or so in a year.
Public Works mentions those on their website, but they don't really explain them.
Yeah, let's go to the phones. Brad in Baltimore has a call into Midday. Welcome to the program. Glad you called.
Yes, thank you very much, Tom. And great, good luck with your retirement from Fort Arts.
Well, I appreciate that. We ain't talking music today, though, Brad. We're talking water. What's on your mind?
Yeah, the two things I wanted to talk about. One is that I've been a minimal water user for the last number of years, and I really objected to paying for the sewer when I was using hardly any water. So finally, I got an arrangement with the city not to charge me for sewer. I still pay. I was paying the minimum for water. Now it's probably next to nothing because I hardly ever use any. So I'm just suggesting that people that feel like they're being overcharged for sewer because they don't use a lot of water, perhaps contact the billing department and see if they can work out a similar arrangement.
Well, you are the facts of. You're one lucky guy because I have never heard of this arrangement. And Susan, have you?
No, never.
I mean, Brad, yeah. Why are you using so little water? You're living in your
home? Because I'm not there. I'm not there in the house to use water.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
You've told. I mean, right now they have switched to a flat rate schedule, Joan. Right? I mean, the rates that people are being charged are now across the board the same. It used to be that there was something called declining block structure.
Yeah, that was for industrial users if you were a business that used a huge amount of water, you were given a discount. But they've stopped that.
All right, so everybody pays the same rate.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Brad, that doesn't sound like something that's available to an awful lot of people. But I appreciate the call. Thanks for calling in, Roger Colton. You have suggested a plan that's been taken up by the city of Philadelphia to base rates on income that people report. Can you explain how that program works?
Sure. The City Council of Philadelphia just 1 year ago, right about this week, unanimously approved a program that for low-income households would set water and sewer bills equal to an affordable percentage of income. And the thinking behind the City Council was that it made no sense to, from a business perspective, setting aside the social issues of affordable water, but from the business perspective of the local water department and from the City of Philadelphia, it made no sense to send bills to people that people could not afford to pay because the water department was not collecting that money and it was spending a lot of money in its unsuccessful attempts to make such collections.
And your argument then is part fiscal as well as compassion in that you're saying that if the water, the entity that provides the water can collect some pennies on the dollar, it's better than zero pennies on the dollar, right? I mean, and what does the data show about that? I mean, once they go to this kind of system, do they expect, in fact, to maintain the revenue they currently have? Do they expect it to go up? Do they expect it to go down? Will their expenses be the same? How are they affected? What do you think the impact economically on the municipality, in this case Philadelphia, is going to be?
Well, and looking at the compassion is an important thing, but let's just set that aside for the moment and look only at the fiscal impact. What the City of Philadelphia believes and what other similar programs in the energy industry have demonstrated is that when a utility adopts a program like this, they will collect more money and spend less in the process of collection. The way to conceptualize the notion is that it is better to collect 90% of a $70 bill than it is to collect 60% of a $100 bill. Because even though you're billing fewer dollars, you're collecting more cash and you're spending less in the process. So overall, as a bit from a purely business perspective, you're better off.
And they, in fact, the Philadelphia City Council was persuaded that that's what was going to happen. Is there any data? I mean, obviously, it hasn't gone into effect yet in Philadelphia. It goes into effect in 2017. But what's the actual research data on this?
In Pennsylvania, every regulated electric and natural gas utility has a low-income bill affordability program. And many, in fact, most of those programs are income-based. And what the Pennsylvania utilities have found, what the New Jersey utilities have found, which have a similar program, what the Colorado utilities have found is that low-income customers who are billed an affordable rate actually pay their bills, or billed an affordable bill, actually pay their bills between 90 and 100% of the time. That is an increase from people who pay their bills between 50 and 60% of the time when they do not receive an affordable bill. So the actual dollar collections, the cash in hand, has increased for utilities that have adopted such programs.
And Susan Francis, you coordinate lawyers who work pro bono to represent clients who are in this very difficult pickle. Does that ring true to you, what Roger Colton is saying?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the other piece to layer onto this is, again, putting compassion aside for a minute, there's the financial reality to this. There's also the community stability issue. And so we, in conjunction with the Pro Bono Resource Center, every spring conducts tax sale clinics for individuals who are at risk of going to tax sale. And what we found is 75% of the individuals that come to our clinic are at risk of tax sale for water bills.
75%?
Yes.
Almost everybody,
essentially. Almost everybody, exactly. Yeah. 50% are seniors. Over half of them have no mortgage on their house. And when a house goes to tax sale, they lose their home. They lose all equity in their home. So we have individuals who have a house they own free and clear, and they're at risk of losing it for $750. That's the threshold at which either a water bill or a property tax puts it into tax sale.
Right, so it's $250 to have your water shut off, and it's $750, which is still an awfully low amount, it seems to me.
Yes, exactly.
To actually animate a possible tax foreclosure.
And here's another interesting thing the city does. The city will combine different kinds of fees and penalties that you have. So once you sort of meet a individual threshold, so what we've seen in the past, the threshold used to be $350 or $250 for property tax. So they would take your water bill and combine that with an environmental citation and combine that. And next thing you know, you're in tax sale. And I think, you know, on a community level, you think about these are seniors. The average time they'd been in their home was 28 years. I mean, they are invested in their communities. And I don't know about you, but I live in the city. These are the folks I want living near me, right? They're
sure,
home during the day.
Sure, they've been here for almost 30 years.
Right, they're invested.
Especially the seniors. They're the eyes and ears of the block
exactly.
Most of the time.
They know who's supposed to be there, who's not supposed to be there. And the outcome is they lose their home, generally the home in which they owe, that they've worked very hard for, and then we have a vacant. And I think we all know that Baltimore City does not need more vacant properties. Any of the numbers you look at, we're facing between 30 and 60,000 vacant properties in the city. So again, putting the compassion aside for a minute, you know, this does not make sense either from a financial standpoint or from a community stability standpoint.
All right, we're going to take a little break. We will have more on water affordability with Joan Jacobson, the author of a new report commissioned by the Able Foundation, Roger Colton, a consultant in Belmont, Massachusetts, and Susan Francis, an attorney with the Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Services. Love to hear from you. Give us a call here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Join us after this quick break. Stick around.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. You're joining us for Midday, and we are delighted. If you've just joined us, we're talking about how the increasing water rates in Baltimore City are affecting low-income households and what we can do about it. My guests are Joan Jacobson, a freelance journalist and the author who has written a report about water affordability for the Able Foundation. She joins me in the studio along with Susan Francis. She's the deputy director of Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Services. Roger Colton joins us on the line from Belmont, Massachusetts. He's a consultant who studies energy and utilities, among other things. He's developed a model to determine what he calls the home energy affordability gap. We'd love to have you be part of our conversation about water affordability here on Midday. Our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall, our email address midday@wypr.org, and our telephone number 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. I want to talk a little bit about legislation that may be coming down the pike as we continue to grapple with this issue. But before I do, Roger Colton, what's your take on the frequency of billing, the fact that, for example, here in Baltimore, we're now getting bills once a month instead of every quarter? I mean, there is a thought or an aspiration, I think, that we will all, each of us who are consumers of water in Baltimore City, will be smarter about what it is we're using, how much we're consuming. It might lead us to be more frugal with our water usage, kind of way the Baltimore Gas and Electric Company now tells us, you know, how we compare to our neighbors in terms of our energy use for electric and gas. Have you thought about this in terms of billing people for energy and services? I mean, does it matter how that's done from that perspective?
I have thought about that and worked with utilities that have moved from quarterly to monthly billing. And there is indeed a population of customers where moving from quarterly billing to monthly billing will help, because each of the bills will be lower. But there is, in contrast, a population of customers where the annual bill is simply unaffordable. It is not a budgeting problem. And low-income people are actually very good at budgeting their expenditures. Their problem is not that they budget or that they budget poorly or that they waste water, but that their bills as a percentage of their income are simply too high. And for those folks, moving to a monthly bill will not have a beneficial impact.
And Joan Jacobson, let's talk about some legislation that is being thought about. We got an email from Delegate Mary Washington, who was not able to join us today, even to call in. She says that she's planning to introduce several bills around water affordability, right, and protecting consumers against water shutoff and losing their homes to tax sale, the issue that Susan Francis has been so closely aligned with, disclosure of shutoff practices, notice to consumers. She's planning to introduce those during the upcoming assembly. What else is out there?
Okay, well, before I get into that, I just wanted to add to what Roger said that by the city's own account, very recently, they gave me the typical residential water bill in Baltimore is now $780 a year and going up. So that's pretty substantial. And obviously for larger families, it's going to be more. And so it's beginning to rival property taxes. So I wanted to say that. But as far as legislation, to follow up on what Mary wrote in her email, I spoke to her this morning. She is planning on introducing four bills, and very quickly, one will ban water shutoffs statewide for households that have people who are disabled or who have children. It will ban water shutoff for tenants when the water bill is not in their name but in the name of the property owner. The second bill will remove water liens from tax sale statewide. And the third one will establish some kind of advisory commission to review the water affordability standards and rate proposals so citizens can have a say. If I can quickly explain, in Baltimore City, the water rates are first decided by the mayor's appointed finance director and public works director, and then the water rates are finally decided and voted on by the Board of Estimates, which is controlled by the mayor and her appointed public works director and finance director.
So it works differently, for example, like when BGE wants to have a rate hike, there they have to go to this commission and they have to prove it. And so, but there's no internal check and balance.
There's nothing.
So they just decide what the number has to be. And as you say, the federal government's no longer funding the infrastructure improvements.
Right.
So they're looking at that. I mean, you know, these bills that Delegate Washington is talking about introducing, and then Bill Henry on the city council is also talking about introducing some local bills.
Right.
Wouldn't it be if you're in the Department of Public Works, wouldn't you sit around and say, well, that's all great, except we got $2 billion we've got to find.
Right. Well, so Mary wants to also introduce a statewide bill based on Roger Colton's model. And the city council is by the spring going to introduce a city bill that will set water and sewer rates based on a percentage of income based on Roger Colton's model. And the city council also will hopefully introduce a bill that would ban water liens from tax sale in the city. And the Water for All Coalition is working on all of this legislation with city council and state legislatures. I know one of the things that they have done is getting in touch with the new members of the city council.
All right, we got a whole bunch of folks who are on the telephone. Laura, you're on the phone from Baltimore. Thanks for your call to Midday. You're on with Joan Jacobson, Susan Francis, and Roger Colton.
Hi. My understanding is that Baltimore County also gets its water from the city. And having, you know, seen what Baltimore County residents pay for water and also knowing how much lower their property taxes are, I was wondering if any of your folks there can speak to what that arrangement is. Is there a way the city can renegotiate that in some way so there's a little more equitable spread of expense for all the people
Joan
that are
Jacobson,
using the water?
So the county does purchase water from the city.
Yes, the county purchases water from the city. The county has its own water utility. Obviously, they have to pay the city for water, but they set their own rates. And they have some set fees that are different from cities' fees. It's a little hard to compare them. But I think in the end, Baltimore County's total water and sewer rates are a little less than the city. But the county also has its own EPA consent decree to replace its own aging infrastructure. So they have problems as well.
Are they assessing an infrastructure fee and an administrative fee the way the city is?
Yeah, they're not called the same, but they've been doing that for years. So whether the city can renegotiate with the county on what they charge, I don't know. I will tell you that a few years ago, the city was going to hire a company to evaluate the whole water utility to see if it was running efficiently, and they never hired the company. So I don't think there's been any recent study to see if there's an efficiency in the water utility. Well,
and we're certainly way behind on fulfilling the obligation under the consent decree. And Susan Francis, just to be clear, the clients that you work with are in the city of Baltimore. You don't deal with clients outside of Baltimore, right?
Yes and no. So my organization and our coalition does help statewide, but again, it's around this water bill issue, which is primarily focused in Baltimore City. So Baltimore County, for example, doesn't have water bill tax sale issues because they don't have the authority to do it, because it's the Baltimore City Department of Public Works that's providing the
right. So if you live in Baltimore, if you live in Baltimore County, you can't lose your home for an unpaid water bill. But if you live in the city, you can.
Yes.
Paul in Annapolis, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I'm on the road. Can you hear me?
I can. What's on your mind?
I had three quick points I'd like to make, and I'll take the responses off the air. One, I'm reminded of Margaret Thatcher's comment about socialism, is that it's a wonderful system until you run out of other people's money. It's clear that years have gone by without a proper maintenance of the systems that we have and increasing their capacity. Two, it's conservation of water in older homes is a very important part. There's a lot of water that is produced that is just wasted because of bad conservation within the home and within the city. And three, it is far cheaper to replace a infrastructure like that for water and sewer when you can replace in place, where you don't have to tear it up, but you can reline them. And now with interest rates so low, it would be a good time to get started.
Yeah, well, and they've got $2 billion worth of stuff to do one way or the other, so let's hope they do it in an effective way. Eric from Baltimore sends us an email with a couple of points, and they're good ones. Why are fees for automatic credit card payments usurious? Way above everywhere else. It seems like water encouraging the water department is encouraging mistakes to happen, and that's true. If you try to pay your bill with your credit card automatically, you pay this incredible fee. It's just really not worth doing. He also says, why are Baltimore City residents, the only jurisdiction in the state, still paying the stormwater fee rain tax? The short answer to that question, I guess, is that there are people, other jurisdictions, taking money out of other funds to fund that. But it's interesting that Baltimore does still remain the only one with a specific fee for stormwater. And he also says, why did the city not fight the unfunded Homeland Security mandate to cover drinking water? I don't know anything about that. He says that New York City won an exemption to that. Susan, do you happen to know anything about that?
No.
Roger Colton, you know anything about that?
I am not familiar with that, no.
All right. Well, Eric, you have stumped the panel. Congratulations. You get to go on to our grand prize round. Tina in Baltimore City, thanks for your call. Welcome to Midday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question about the infrastructure fee. And I'm on the web page where the city, the DPW, has the rate structure. And I noticed that the rate for the sewer stayed about the same, but the rate for the water dropped by about half. And so I was curious if the infrastructure fees were being put towards water delivery and or the sewer.
Well, the infrastructure fee is new. It's brand new. And so it's one of two set fees that you're going to get. As I said, starting next year, it'll be $226 a year in addition to your water rate. So I'm not
I'm glancing at my own water bill here, and I have an account management fee, an infrastructure charge, a stormwater fee, which is $40, and the bay restoration fee, which is $20. So that's right there. It's about $70 just in fees. It has nothing to do with how much I've consumed.
And what DPW will tell you is that the administrative fee and the infrastructure fee were already built into your bill, so there's no additional charge for that.
That's
which
not true.
Just isn't true.
Totally not true. You're still, it's a new fee.
All right. Well, we are going to have to call it quits there, but this is not certainly the last time we will deal with the issue of water affordability. So I really appreciate all of you. Joan Jacobson is the author of a report commissioned by the Able Foundation called Keeping the Water On, Strategies for Addressing High Increases in Water and Sewer Rates for Baltimore's Most Vulnerable Customers. We've got a link to the report on our website, wypr.org/midday. Roger Colton has joined us from his office outside of Boston. He's a principal with the consulting firm of Fisher, Sheehan & Colton. He studied how municipalities set rates for water consumption and how they can make it affordable for low-income residents. Susan Francis is an attorney with Maryland Volunteer Lawyers Services. They've been helping folks whose homes are put up for tax sales, often because of unpaid water bills. Thanks to all of you. Really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, Rudy Chow, the director of the Baltimore Department of Public Works, declined to appear on our show today, and the department did not offer another person to speak on its behalf. They did send a written statement, which we will post on our website. Again, come to wypr.org/midday for links to both the ABLE report and the DPW response. That'll do it for us today. Tomorrow, we examine the conclusions of another report commissioned by the ABLE Foundation. This one having to do with youth homelessness. There are more young people facing housing insecurity than had ever been previously thought. More than 1,400 kids do not know where they're going to sleep or how they're going to eat on any given night in Baltimore. We'll meet an amazing young man named Danny Jones, who experienced homelessness for most of his childhood. We'll hear how he has gone from homeless to hopeful as he pursues a college degree. You will not want to miss meeting him tomorrow on Midday. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guests today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours on the web at joesquared.com. www.tomhall.com. Thanks to you for listening. Here and Now is up next after a break for the news. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.